In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the international effort to control the spread of biological weapons. Back in 1972, more than 140 countries, including the United States, signed on to the Biological Weapons Convention, which prohibited the development, the production, and the possession of biological weapons. When that treaty was negotiated, however, something important was left out. It had no provision for verification. In 1995, then, an international group began working on an inspection protocol, and this group presented a draft proposal in March. Representatives of the governments of Europe said that while this protocol was not perfect, they would support it. The Bush administration, however, has come out against this proposal, saying that it was flawed beyond repair. Now, the administration has also said that it remains committed to the Biological Weapons Convention itself and would suggest alternative means of enforcement, although they haven't made much progress in that area quite yet. And there are people who are concerned that the position of the administration might mean that the whole effort, that is the whole convention, might go by the wayside. We'll be talking this morning about this whole issue with a guest, Dr. Barbara Hatch Rosenberg. She's a molecular biologist. She teaches at the State University of New York. Before that, she was on the faculty of the Cornell Medical College. In addition, she chairs the Federation of American Scientists Working Group on Biological Weapons. And she's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. All we ask is that people just try to be brief so we can keep moving along and get everybody in who would like to join the conversation. But anybody can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel. Of course, even, and if you're listening on the Internet, you can call in. It's 800-222-9455. Again, locally, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Dr. Rosenberg, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. Why is it that when this treaty was negotiated in 1972, that there was no mechanism for verification built into it then?
1972 was the height of the Cold War, and it was obvious to everyone that Russia would never sign on to this if they tried to do any on-site verification. So that was one reason. The second reason was it was considered at the time that biological weapons had no military utility anyway. They were too uncertain, unpredictable, and they wouldn't be giving up anything, and they wouldn't have to worry. So they negotiated it without verification procedures in order to get the treaty done quickly. After the Cold War began to thaw in 1986, there continued to be pushes to do something to strengthen the prohibition, the ban on biological weapons. And in 1986, some voluntary information exchange was undertaken. It didn't turn out to be very effective. So by 1991, when the Cold War was essentially over, it was possible to talk about making legally binding measures on verification for the ban. And at that time, a feasibility study was undertaken by the parties to the treaty, the 140-odd parties at the time. The feasibility study took a couple of years, and experts from the parties looked at possible measures for verification and came out with a report that, in fact, there are measures that could be used that would be that are feasible and would be effective in strengthening the convention. So, therefore, negotiations were undertaken in 1995 and have continued for 6.5 years. And a text was gradually developed. Finally, because there were some points that were still controversial, the chairman of the negotiations developed a compromise text, which is the one that's on the table now, and which the U.S. has rejected. And in rejecting it, they rejected not only the particular compromises in the text, but they rejected the entire concept of a monitoring, a protocol that would monitor, a treaty that would monitor compliance with the ban. They said that the entire basis for this treaty is useless, and they would not go along with anything like it whatsoever. This has been a terrible blow to all the rest of the world. There were 55 other countries involved in this negotiation, and of the 140 parties, all of them were welcome to participate. Those who didn't were those who were too small or too busy with pressing other activities. But if they had objected, they would have been there to object. So basically, all the other parties to the treaty have said they wanted to see a protocol, a treaty concluded. All the parties to the convention, the ban, have said they wanted this verification treaty concluded this year on the basis of the chairman's compromise text. Only the U.S., standing all alone in the world, has rejected it. This puts us in a position beyond that of what we normally think of as rogue states, many of which are saying that they want to see this convention, this protocol, finalized this year. Mm-hmm. So it's a blow to the international norm that opposes the possession and use, actually the total existence of biological weapons, because it's saying to potential proliferators that the United States is itself and the whole world, because the U.S. is standing in the way, are not willing to go on record as saying that they want to enforce this treaty. It's sort of giving them a green light. It's very bad news.
It's my understanding that the inspection procedures are fairly complex. At least what I've read is that the proposal is more than 200 pages long. Is it possible to, in brief, talk a little bit about just what the verification protocol looks like?
Yes, it's really it's very long, because countries these days, want to see every detail in writing. The original convention, the ban, was only a page and a half, and most arms treaties have been very short. But when the Chemical Weapons Convention was adopted a couple of years ago, it brought in a new fad in international arms treaties by spelling out in great detail every aspect of it, and countries involved have continued with that tradition. The protocol, first of all, we're calling it a protocol. This is the treaty that would strengthen the ban on biological weapons. So if I say protocol, you'll know what I'm talking about. It is a separate treaty, but it's open only to the parties who have signed on to the convention that bans biological weapons. The protocol has to be viewed as only one component of a comprehensive strategy to protect against biological weapons. It is an element of deterrence, along with biological defenses and export controls. This protocol would monitor compliance with the ban. And to do this, it means providing measures that require countries to be open about their biological activities, because you can't prohibit them. Too many of the activities that would be needed to make biological weapons are also needed to make vaccines, drugs, and other peaceful purposes, which are necessary and can't be prohibited. So the answer that the protocol provides is that these activities have to be carried out with a limited degree of openness, so that everybody knows that you're doing them and where you're doing them. And if they have concerns about it, they can keep their eye on it, but they can determine that they believe from the evidence that's supplied and to provide openness that it's probably peaceful and not threatening. The protocol does this by requiring annual declarations of the kinds of facilities, that is to say, installations or laboratories, factories, plants, defense installations, those that would be the most relevant for making biological weapons have to be declared. That is to say, those that might have that have capabilities that could be used for making weapons, but also have other purposes. So they have to be declared every year, and some information provided as to what their purpose is and what's going on there. Then there will be a standing inspectorate for this treaty, which will carry out random visits to randomly selected declared sites to make sure that what they've declared is true. And there will be a procedure, or there would be a procedure for clarifying declarations if there are questions, if they are ambiguous. Another party can ask, well, what do you mean by this, and shouldn't you have declared something else that isn't in here? And those procedures would proceed through discussions into on-site visits if necessary to clarify the point. And in serious situations, one any member of the treaty could challenge another one about an activity that's going on anytime or anywhere, not just declared sites. They could bring a challenge, and then the inspectors would go to that site and within a few days would have to gain access to determine whether there was something illicit that would violate the ban going on at that site. So all of these are means by which activities can be made open and can be checked on and monitored to make certain that they're peaceful. At the same time, there's the problem of protecting industry and protecting security information about defenses, that we don't want it to be known exactly what we can and what we can't defend against in the way of biological weapons, which kinds of pathogens, say, we have vaccines for, or et cetera. So there are very strict protections in this protocol for that kind of thing. I've seen government officials saying inspectors, international inspectors who actually come from Libya or Iraq can be going through our defense plants or our vaccine or pharmaceutical plants. This isn't true. There will be international inspectors, and they will be under strict rules with penalties to maintain secrecy and never mention anything that they've learned in the inspections. And every country that may be inspected has the opportunity to vet these international inspectors, say, well, we will not accept this one. We might just not want any from Iraq, for example, and we could make that stipulation. So every inspector has been vetted and accepted as passable for the country in which it would, any country in which he might carry out an inspection. Hmm. Also, during visits or inspections, the country that's visited has total control over access given to the inspectors. In a challenge inspection, they carry out what's known as managed access, where if they don't want to give the kind of access that the inspector asks for, they have to find some alternate means for answering a question that the inspector may have. But these are very carefully drawn up and detailed measures describing what can and what cannot be done on site with extremely strong protections for confidential information.
Let me right here introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. We're speaking with Dr. Barbara Rosenberg. She is research professor at the State University of New York at Purchase. She also is chair of the Federation of American Scientists Working Group on Biological Weapons. And we're talking about the effort to control the spread of these weapons and an international convention on biological weapons that was first ratified by more than 140 countries, including ours, in 1972. However, it lacked an enforcement mechanism. Now, as a result of a number of years of work, a proposal for such a mechanism is now on the table, and the hope was that it could be adopted by November, sometime in November. And all of the parties to this discussion have supported it except the United States. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. You touched on one of the objections that has been raised by the administration. That is this issue that either national information important to national security or proprietary secrets, if we might be talking about, a laboratory of a pharmaceutical company, or perhaps we might also be talking about, say, a university that was interested in maintaining control over information about the research that they were doing. That's sort of one thing that they have talked about. The other thing the administration has said is that if a country was interested in producing biological weapons, they might very likely not, they won't want to declare that they have this effort going and could very well be carrying on that effort in secret. And if that was the case, then this convention and this protocol wouldn't do anything about that. So their objection basically is that it's still much too easy for a country to cheat and go ahead and do this work. And this agreement wouldn't have any way of preventing that.
Let me answer your second one first. In fact, there's a big advantage in what in forcing countries to do what you say, that is to say, operate in secret, because the simplest way for a country to violate the ban and not be noticed would be to carry out, to make biological weapons in a pharmaceutical plant, let's say, which they would have to declare. Now, If they were operating in a pharmaceutical plant, they could legitimately buy equipment, they could carry on activities, they could work with pathogens and so on, and nobody would raise any questions. But if they have to do it, if they have to become clandestine about it, they have to carry it out in some secret site, which they don't declare, and that means it's very difficult for them to get materials. Any traffic in and out and activities might be spotted. It's very difficult to keep such activities totally secret and to be able to carry out a viable program. So by requiring this kind of openness, it's true that they might go become carry out the thing out covertly, but it becomes a much more difficult thing to do. It increases the price they have to pay than the difficulties they would have in carrying out a biological weapons program. And because they would be reluctant to use a declared site for making biological weapons, and because they would be afraid that they might be detected because of the possible random visits and so on. So by forcing proliferators to go into clandestine operation, the treaty has a value. It means that all of those sites that are declared and inspected and so on, we can pretty much strike off of our intelligence calendar and concentrate our focus, our national intelligence means, on any sites that we might find out about that aren't declared, that may look suspicious because they might be carrying out something, something in a hidden way.
Hmm. Was there something else you wanted to add to this other issue of, again, the administration has said they're concerned about the fact that if we have inspectors going through, you talked about defense installations, but also there have been questions raised about private businesses or, say, university laboratories. And once again, there seems to be this concern about the ability to protect, to preserve secrecy about either trade secrets or perhaps somebody is working on a particular thing and they just as soon not have everybody know about what they've learned so far, and that this, again, there would be this opportunity for this kind of information to leak out.
Well, first of all, academic laboratories don't have to be declared and really don't come into the picture at all. Hmm. They have no liability, no intrusion, no nothing. In industrial activities, would some of them be covered, and so would biological defense activities and facilities. But the United States has been very cautious throughout these negotiations and has insisted on a great many restrictions, which not all countries agreed with, but which they have reluctantly gone ahead with because the United States has insisted. And those requirements of the United States government and also those specified by U.S. Pharmaceutical industries have all been incorporated into the compromise text. So the U.S. complaints on that score are really disingenuous. Everything that they and industry have asked for are in there, and all of their interests are extremely well taken care of in this text, and to the point that many, including my group, feel that the text has been unnecessarily weakened. For example, under biodefense facilities, only very limited types and only of a large size are required to be declared. There really are loopholes there that would require, that would permit defense activities, which might actually be offensive, to be carried out by countries. But at least they would have to be rather small scale to be exempted. But there are exemptions there, and they were required by the U.S., and they were put in there. So I don't think that that's a valid argument at all on their part. And just to demonstrate the U.S. attitude on this, the United States conducted a review of its policy on this treaty as shortly after the Bush administration came in, and that review was completed by the end of March, at the same time that the chairman's text was released. But the United States attended a negotiated session after that, when all the other countries discussed the chairman's text and suggested changes and so on. The U.S. said nothing because they claimed that they hadn't completed their review. And the reason was that they knew they were going to reject the thing no matter what changes might be made, because the Bush administration's view about treaties in general is negative, as you must know, with the Kyoto Protocol, the small arms, the nuclear, the nuclear missile treaty,
the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty,
and so on. I mean, the general attitude of the Bush administration is that treaties are not needed by the U.S. We're a superpower. They simply limit what we can do, and we can do better without them. And we don't give a damn what the rest of the world thinks. Their concerns are secondary, and so the U.S. is willing to go out there and stand alone. I must say, I was in Geneva with the negotiators when the U.S. made the announcement that they were rejecting the treaty, and there was a sort of horrified hush that fell over the group. They were stunned. Even though they knew it was coming, they didn't expect it to be so final and so definitive and delivered in such an arrogant and insulting way in which, in fact, it was delivered. A very long talk which went out of its way to emphasize everything that that any group among the negotiators might take offense at. It was remarkable. But afterward, I spoke to one of the European delegations who said, well, up to this time, we knew the U.S. didn't want the treaty, but we thought at least they wouldn't want to be blamed for rejection and that they would try to be cautious in what they said. But we now know that they really don't give a damn about anybody else, and they're going to do what they want regardless. So this has been a learning experience, which adds on to the experience of the Kyoto Protocol and other negotiations recently.
There had been this hope that this protocol could be adopted sometime in November. Now that the United States has taken the stand that it has, what does that mean, not only for adoption of the protocol, but does that pose, you think, some sort of threat to the convention itself?
The U.S. has gone out of its way on numerous recent occasions to profess its allegiance to the quota, to the convention, which bans biological weapons, at the same time that they reject the protocol that would give it teeth. I again think this is disingenuous, because if you really think that the ban is so great, why reject a way of strengthening it that everybody else in the world wants? Even if they thought it was useless, which they do claim, it's certainly not doing any harm. So, although they will claim that it does, but this claim is really not substantiated by the facts about the protocol. So, I don't think that their reasons given are the true reasons. I think that they are giving reasons largely that would be difficult for non-experts to evaluate, because this is a technical matter, frequently things that are said by U.S. officials on this are actually incorrect, but no one would notice that who isn't an expert at this. My group has been working on this for 12 years, so we pick up these things, and certainly so do all of the negotiators from other countries over in Geneva who are still meeting. They're well aware that a lot of what the U.S. is saying, a lot of its reasons and excuses, don't hold water at all. But it's very difficult to explain this to a non-expert.
Mm. We do have a caller to talk with, and I think, again, this morning we have someone who's listening to us on the web, because the caller is in San Francisco. It's a little outside of our coverage area. Let's do that. We'll talk with them on our line number 4. Hello.
Hey, morning. You know, yesterday you had a good interview with Carl Grossman, and in it he was talking about the subterfuges that the military-industrial complex and Bush administration are up to. You know, they're advertising one thing with Star Wars and responding, and their reality is something quite different. And as you're discussing this morning, it you know, that their foreign policy appears to be one thing, but is in reality quite different. It crosses my mind that I heard an interview with the director of the Holocaust Museum in Miami Beach, and he tells us that the Bush family were, for 20 years, they were financing Adolf Hitler from 1924 to 1944, when their last banks were seized as part of trading with the enemy. And to look at the rise of Hitler and the methods that he used, that he would say one thing, but he would entirely lie. And his techniques were essentially the same, that he wanted to destroy everything about the German democracy and rebuild it in the National Socialist model, the fascist model. And I wonder if she has any response to that, whether or not the model of as you just described, all of the treaties are to be dismantled for really capricious or arbitrary reasons. There's no logic to dismantling every major treaty that Congress has put together in the last 25, 50 years. Why would they do that, and except for to build the corporate state?
Well, I think that you've hit on the truth there. I have myself occasionally thought that the Hitler's big lie principle is a current favorite technique of this administration. If you say something sufficiently outrageous, nobody's going to believe it. I mean, it's very easy for the public to assume, well, this has got to be true, and they get away with this kind of thing. I think you're right. And I don't know about the whole Bush family, because I do think that the first Bush, the father of the present president, had quite a different international outlook. He, for example, was a major force in the completion of the Chemical Weapons Convention. Surprisingly, his son is the major force in preventing strengthening of the Biological Weapons Convention. So it's a funny opposition there.
Well, sometimes the appearances are quite deceiving. You know, you have to read the fine print in each of these treaties to know the reality of it. But just for your reference, there's a book called George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography. And the first two chapters talk about the history of his grandfather, Sam Bush, and Herbert Walker, and and then Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current and the father of the former president. And it's amazing. They had a number of banks, and they were financing and money laundering for the Thiessen family. Thiessen was, of course, the largest single contributor to Adolf Hitler, 5 million Deutschmarks in the early 30s. So it's a very, very scary thought to think that these people are very active and not subtle at all in their search for this, brave new world or new world order.
That's really interesting. But just to add a little extra information to that, I do know that the reason that George Bush, the first senior, pushed so hard for chemical weapons control was his mother, who kept on him constantly, much to his annoyance on many occasions, insisted that he do this. And I assume that it was the First World War and the experience of chemical weapons in the trenches that that she knew about and felt strongly about. I know a former member of the CIA who worked for Bush when he was vice president and told me he was present once when the mother called, and he described the conversation, which some of which was unprintable, but she was certainly insisting. Well, he was somewhat reluctant, but he did what she wanted.
Mothers are good.
Well, thanks for the call.
Right,
other people certainly are welcome. If you'd like to call in, ask question, make comment. We are moving into about our last 10, 12 minutes. And our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Barbara Rosenberg. She is research professor at the State University of New York at Purchase. She also is chair of the Federation of American Scientists Working Group on Biological Weapons. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think in what I have read about this and what the administration has said, it makes it appear that perhaps the chief objection that the administration has had is this idea of foreign inspectors perhaps going through U.S. defense plants or installations. To what degree do you think that the administration position might have something to do with a belief, rightly or wrongly, perhaps that the whole issue, that is the proliferation of biological weapons, just isn't something to be worried about?
Are you suggesting that they don't think it's worried?
Yes, maybe I phrased the question poorly. Yes, that's exactly what I'm suggesting.
Well, they may think that. Who knows what they think? But they certainly don't say it, because at the very same time that they were rejecting this, they were saying that they consider biological weapons to be the greatest threat that the United States is exposed to at the moment.
Mm.
Greater than nuclear. So they've made that comment more than once. I think that they must recognize that it is a threat, because one of the things that I would like to bring up now is what's going on scientifically that makes this a growing threat. Biotechnology, the Human Genome Project, especially the Human Genome Variability Project, are creating new means for developing new kinds of biological weapons, which is to say pathogens that can do things and that can be controlled or not controlled in new ways, that could target certain specific groups of people possibly. So the technology is giving new possibilities to the development and use of biological weapons, and that's one reason why we need to act as quickly as possible to control and eliminate these weapons. And if they are, if they do continue to be developed and proliferate, it's going to be Americans who are most likely to be the target of these weapons, because we, as things now stand, as citizens of the only superpower and one that's now perceived widely as arrogant and acting unilaterally and it's only in its own interest, that makes us the most desirable target. And even if nobody ever uses biological weapons, if they're just being developed here and there around the world. There is always a possibility that such new genetically engineered pathogens could escape from laboratories. Things routinely do escape that are supposed to be kept secure. And if they did, they might become established in the biosphere as a new disease and probably an uncontrollable one. So if that happens, this is not something that you can defend against with weapons. This becomes a permanent public health hazard. This is the kind of thing we have to act quickly on now to at least minimize the possibility.
Let's talk with another caller. We have someone in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I enjoy this discussion. I'm a little late, so if I ask the question that you already answered, I apologize. But did America ever take responsibility for using Agent Orange in Vietnam? Would that be considered a biological weapon? I know a lot of our soldiers.
No, but it's considered by many people to be a chemical weapon. Of course, the United States admits that it used Agent Orange. I mean, that's established fact. I don't think it was ever questioned. But they did maintain that it didn't fall under the rubric of chemical weapon. However, the Chemical Weapons Convention that has been adopted now, and the U.S. is a party to, would prohibit, well, it's somewhat ambiguous as to whether it would prohibit Agent Orange, but it certainly prohibits the use of chemicals. There are other treaties, too, that prohibit the use of chemicals that would damage the environment. So there are restrictions that the U.S. Would be subject to in the future.
Yeah, the problem is that you could take something like smallpox or things that we have cured in the past, and I guess through genetics, DNA or genetics, and I'm not an expert like you are, but I guess you could mutate these and they could become a new...
You don't even have to bother mutating them because practically nobody in the world has immunity to smallpox anymore because we don't vaccinate anymore.
Yeah, they've been wiped out.
So smallpox, as it always was, would be an extremely dangerous weapon because it spreads readily, rapidly, easily, and it kills with a fairly high percentage of its victims, and it's a severe disease, and it's something that that you can't cure. We have no cures for it. It's a viral disease, so we don't have immunity. We don't have a cure, and we don't have a stockpile of vaccines at the moment. We have a very small stockpile. The government is ordering more, but it'll take time.
Is it true that the KGB was working on these weapons to see if they could use them for assassination purposes?
Yes, I suppose they were. There was one or two assassinations carried out by the South Africans in particular developed biological weapons for assassination purposes, and they used it rather widely. That means,
you know,
but that's small scale stuff. You know, when we think about biological weapons as a weapon of mass destruction, that's we don't have to. Well, this is what we need the treaty for, because they could wipe out as many people as a nuclear bomb could.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. A madman could use this for another Final Solution or something like that.
Well, that's of course true, especially if you could target certain people and not others.
Groups, yeah.
But there are enough crazy people around who might just want to wipe out the entire human race.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Certainly other questions are welcome. We do have about 6 or 7 minutes left. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Of those nations that we know or we strongly suspect have biological weapons programs, are they are there nations that did not ratify this treaty, that are not signatories to the Biological Weapons Convention?
Yes, not all of them are, but many of them are. Well, for example, we're pretty certain, I am certain, that Israel has a biological weapons program, but it's not a party to the treaty. However, Iran and Iraq are. Syria has signed it. Russia is, and, you know, the big violators in the past are Russia and Iraq. Both of them are parties. Russia, we now know, or the Soviet Union at the time, had enormous stockpiles of smallpox, for example, and plague, and anthrax, the biggest ever biological weapons program. Of course, we had biological weapons at one time, too, but Nixon, with great foresight, unilaterally renounced biological weapons in 1969. He said that mankind already has in its hands too many means of destruction. And he said that we don't need biological weapons for retaliation. We can retaliate with other means, and so we are unilaterally eliminating them. And it was this action that led very quickly to the Biological Weapons Convention that banned them. So that was a very counter type of attitude that Nixon had, another Republican president, to this Republican President Bush.
I suppose there would be some people who would question the commitment of the Russians and the Chinese also to this protocol, and would say that they are probably just pleased to be able to sit back and see the United States scuttle it, because they were not real thrilled about it going into effect either.
Yes, yes, there are a handful of countries who probably feel that way. Actually, I'm not sure about Russia. The point is, though, that if the United States had backed the treaty, along with the other 99% of countries that definitely back it in a meaningful way, the others would have been so isolated that they would not have been willing to stand alone, you see. The U.S., on the other hand, is arrogant enough to stand alone, to be willing to do that. But with U.S. backing, the supporters would have been able to push this through, and I feel certain that Russia, China, and probably Iran would have, I think all the other countries would have gone along with the treaty. Whether they ultimately would have ratified it, some of them would not, probably, but it still would have strengthened the international norm against these weapons, and it would have allowed the countries that were members to take unified action against any that didn't.
Well, I realize we've kind of touched on this point before, but going back to sort of talking about where things go from now, we've had this effort a number of years to produce this protocol, and the hope was that this fall that it could be ratified. Now the United States says that it's no good, that it's flawed. The United States continues to say they're committed to the convention, but they don't like this protocol, and maybe when they get around to it, they'll have some suggestions to make. What happens to this whole effort now?
Yeah. Well, I don't expect anything to come of the alternative suggestions that the U.S., those that have been bandied about so far, have already been privately rejected by other parties in the negotiations, and there is no substitute for this. There's no other way to get in. There are only two ways to get information about what's going on in the biological weapons area, or what might be. One is through intelligence, private spies, on-ground intelligence, because you can't do it at a distance. This is too small scale. So it's either intelligence or it's a treaty that requires information to be provided. So the U.S. has rejected the treaty. We already have intelligence to the extent that it works, but its studies in the past have shown that it has not been very effective in chemical and biological fields. So there is no alternative to this, and the other parties are determined to maintain, to preserve the work that has been done, and to keep the texts around and all the studies that were done in the past. I mean, it was a tremendous amount of work that went into this, and in the hope that at some future time that the United States will come around, as it is bound to do. I'm certain that there will be a treaty like this sooner or later, and that eventually the U.S. will be forced to sign on. Take the Geneva Protocol, for example, was the first treaty of 1925 that outlawed the use of biological weapons, but not their development and possession, but their use. The United States did not ratify that treaty until 1975, and we did have biological weapons in the interim. We didn't use them, but we actually considered using them during World War II. We developed anthrax bombs and for the British, and the British were going to use them jointly with the U.S. if the war hadn't ended when it did. So we were not abiding by, we were not members of the protocol that banned their use until 1975. I think times move faster now, so I suspect that if there is a treaty that without the United States, eventually they would have to join on. But I think that that most parties want to have the U.S. in on it and would not go ahead without them, but that they can continue to press and that sooner or later we're going to get a better administration and a different Congress and that something will happen. I would like to make another comment, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned several times that the U.S. keeps protesting its support for the ban, the convention.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that the one reason for this U.S. protest is the admission by our chief negotiator in congressional hearings this in July 10th, that some U.S. government activities, quote, raise ambiguities regarding their purpose. In other words, as to whether they mightn't violate the ban. And I think that that one motive for rejecting the protocol is that there are things going on in our biological defense program that might look to be something more than defensive, and that the U.S. doesn't want this to get out, and in spite of all of the loopholes that have been built into the compromise text, they're still worried.
Well, we will have to stop because we're at the end of the time. I want to say, Dr. Rosenberg, thank you very much for giving us your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
You're very welcome.